Harry Constable in his own words. Episode 11. The Blue and the White.
In 1954, I joined the National Amalgamated Stevedores and Dockers Union. This union was known as the Blue because of the colour of the union subscription card, while the main union on the docks, the Transport and General Workers Union, was known as the White.
1954 was also the year that 4,000 hull dockers came out on unofficial strike against an antiquated and dangerous method of unloading grain known as hand scuttling. Men had to stand up to their waists and deeper in loose grain in the hold of a ship and shovel grain into sacks with big metal scoops. Hand scuttling had been described as a rotten, dirty, underpaid job that should have died with Queen Victoria.
The White Union had tolerated hand scuttling for years, but significantly this unofficial action abolished it on the Hull docks. All the frustration and seething discontent felt by these dockers at the setup in the White suddenly came to a head. A mass meeting of striking dockers in August 1954 decided to apply for membership of the Blue Union. 4 weeks later, Birkenhead dockers agreed to follow Hull's example, then Manchester and Liverpool. The determination of the White Union leadership to exclude its membership from the union machinery had created this mass opposition. Many men, good trade unionists, had said to me, "I'm tired of paying hard-earned money to a bunch of tired men who can only repeat, 'Our hands are tied.'" The White Union attitude to disputes on the docks was slow and cumbersome. The sheer nature of the loading and discharging of cargoes called for solving the dispute aboard ship as soon as possible, maybe that day, because the next day the ship might be sailing and the port workers would be moved to another ship. It was never in the workers' interest to be unreasonable. They would be out of pocket. But if the dispute was not settled, they were left with only one alternative: to stop the job. Unlike a factory where a dispute could go on for days or months, the port worker had to get results when the ship was in port.
The Blue Union represented an alternative union to the White because it had a more democratic structure with elected officials who were paid very little more than the average dock worker. Decisions were taken not by the union bureaucracy, but by the members themselves at mass meetings. Dockers remembered that the Blue had given official support to the strike which followed the boycott of ships during the Canadian Seamen's Dispute in 1949, and they had also called an official strike over the threat to sack ineffective dockers, a strike which was still talked of in 1954 as having prevented a mass sacking of old or infirm dockers.
The White Union, on the other hand, was so out of touch it was unbelievable. And when thousands of their members were queuing up to join the Blue Union, all they could say from their ivory tower was, "It's illegal to leave us, you must come back." People outside the dock industry must have wondered how this Alice in Wonderland situation had come to pass. But the Blue also constituted a very big threat to the dock employers. It would take workers out of the hands of a compliant and acquiescent union and allow them the democracy that would lead to improved pay and conditions. Initially, after 12,000 dockers in Liverpool had moved to the Blue, the employers said they would recognise it if the White Union agreed.
Of course, the White Union didn't. They chose to go to the TUC and accuse the Blue Union of poaching members. After this, everything was piled in against the Blue: the papers, the TUC, the employers and the government.
I had been constantly spending time in the north, helping port workers to strengthen their groups, and I was officially sent with Bert Aylward to help organise the Blue Union in the northern ports. Bert became the main recruitment organiser. During this recruitment, men were leaving the ships in droves to sign up with the Blue and to transfer their membership from the White Union. We had 4,000 or 5,000 members sign up in 3 weeks. In Birkenhead by this time, there was only a handful left in the white. The popular nature of the movement was shown in the large attendances at branch meetings. Hundreds of dockers were swept into trade union branch activity for the first time in their lives. Many, acting as branch officers and committee members, gained their first experience of organising administration and meeting procedures. The white union threatened dockers with the loss of their jobs if they joined the blue. This action was met with anger and contempt from the mass of dockers in both unions.
In April 1955, an attempt to deprive blue union members of their livelihood was decisively defeated. Dockers of both unions immediately stopped work when blue union men were refused registration books because they could not produce a white union card. After a 2-day strike, the dock labour boards in Manchester and Merseyside capitulated, and the first attempt to bludgeon men back into the white union had failed miserably.
One story about the unity between the two unions was at a hiring when dockers were asked to show their cards. Some men pulled out of their pockets the ace of spades or the jack of diamonds. In the Gladstone dock, the superintendent, Charles Swanee, went to hire a gang. There were both blue and white men present, but he only picked from the white union men. When he tapped Pat Flynn, a white member, on the shoulder, Pat turned round and immediately said to him, "Sorry, Charlie, we're snookered behind the blue." Another docker started to sing, "You can't have one, you can't have one, you can't have one without the other." Soon, all 2,000 men in the control were singing the chorus from the song Love and Marriage. "Oh, you can't have one, you can't have one, you can't have one without the other."
In May, a meeting of the Blue Union proposed strike action if the employers did not grant recognition. The recommendation went before mass meetings in London, Hull, Manchester, Liverpool and Birkenhead.
Everywhere the strike call was endorsed by decisive majorities. A statement issued by the White Union on the eve of the strike called on its docker members to remain at work and declared that only a reign of anarchy and terror could result from the Blue Union's action. Such language testifies to their state of panic. The TUC General Council condemned the strike and demanded that the Blue Union hand back the Northern men to the White Union. The TUC obviously felt that what the dockers thought or what they wanted wasn't important. For the TUC, the matter was one of making suitable arrangements at the top. The ranks could simply be herded around to suit the needs of union bosses.
Over 20,000 dockers stopped work on the first day of the strike. In addition, 7,000 white union members came out in sympathy. The white leadership was desperately afraid that the strike would spread. Leaders of the union declared they were willing to spend £9 million to break the strike. Now that it was a question of defending the union bureaucracy, there seemed to be no barriers to the amount of resources that the union could unleash, something which the dockers had not often seen in conflicts with their employers.
The strike lasted 6 weeks. The men received no strike pay and suffered very real hardship. But in the end, it was not a break in the militancy of the rank and file which prevented victory. If the outcome had rested solely on this, then there is no doubt that the Blue Union would have won. The Blue Union leadership, based in London, had fought half-heartedly. They backed the struggle in the beginning, but found the pressure too much. Literally running away when things started to get hot. Instead of inaugurating a wide campaign throughout the working class to emphasise beyond doubt that this was a fight for recognition, they were content to play around with the TUC on the poaching issue. A determined stand could have won the strike for the dockers, and recognition for the union on a national scale. Instead, the Blue Union agreed to throw 10,000 members out of their own organisation at the orders of the TUC, leaving Dockers, who had joined only months before, abandoned, leaderless and unionless. The Blue had welcomed the Northern men into the union only to end up letting them down, while flouting their own democratic traditions. The Communist Party leadership played a particularly treacherous role in events. They had opposed joining the Blue Union and the strike. These were historic happenings. The Dockers themselves had nothing whatever to be ashamed of. Those of us looking on could only admire and be grateful to those who did the actual fighting. It is to their eternal credit that they stuck it out and put up such a fight. The road to socialism is a difficult road. The working class will suffer many defeats before it rises in its truth and might.
If Fatty don't go, then I don't go. If Fatty don't go, then I don't go. If Fatty don't go, then I don't go. The docks were at a standstill. If Fatty don't go, then I don't go. If Fatty don't go, then I don't go. If Fatty don't go, then I don't go.
Harry Constable, in his own words, as told to Bill Hunter, was read by Christopher Eccleston and Ethna Brown.
These podcasts were produced by Richie Hunter and John G. Davis. Recording and editing was by Richie Hunter. Alan Parry provided his song If Parry Don't Go, with additional music from Piers O'Carroll and Richie Hunter. Paul Hunt at Nerd Magazine did the design and the IT. Help and advice was given by Marty Snape and Ian at the Floddy. All episodes were taken from the book Harry Constable, in his own words, published by Living History Library in 2017. It's available at News from Nowhere and other good bookshops, or you could ask your local library to stock it.